May 10, 1940. Hitler's forces had already devoured Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, and the Netherlands with terrifying efficiency. Now, on this spring morning, they launched their Western offensive against France. Britain watched in horror as the seemingly invincible German war machine rolled forward. Within weeks, France would collapse, leaving Britain utterly alone against Nazi Germany. Into this nightmare stepped Winston Churchill, appointed prime minister on the very day Hitler struck. His task seemed impossible: rally a nation facing certain invasion, unite a fractured government, and somehow find a path to victory when defeat appeared inevitable. Yet Churchill possessed something Britain desperately needed: not just strategic brilliance, but an almost theatrical defiance that would prove as crucial as any military weapon. His predecessor, Neville Chamberlain, had earned the nickname Old Umbrella, the Coroner, for his dour demeanor. Churchill, by contrast, was electric, unpredictable, and wholly alive. He immediately appointed himself Minister of Defense, consolidating power and responsibility. A new energy surged through government offices. Civil servants were suddenly seen running through corridors, and Churchill's private secretariat faced unprecedented workloads as he issued crisp directives demanding precision and brevity. Churchill's work habits matched the crisis he faced. He dictated correspondence in scalding baths, received commanders in silk dressing gowns, and worked late into the night, fueled by champagne and brandy. His secretary watched him compose speeches by pacing and testing each word's rhythm aloud, perfecting every phrase like a conductor. When France fell in June 1940, Churchill delivered his legendary "We Shall Fight on the Beaches" address. Only two newspapers gave it headline coverage, and many conservative MPs met it with sullen silence. Yet it succeeded in its true purpose, signaling Britain's resolve to Hitler and America. Churchill understood survival depended on producing enough fighter aircraft. He created the Ministry of Aircraft Production and appointed Lord Beaverbrook, a dangerous little goblin, to lead it. Despite lacking manufacturing experience and suffering poor health, Beaverbrook brought disruptive energy, establishing his ministry in his own mansion with newspaper employees working 12-hour days, 7 days a week. While Churchill rallied Britain, a quieter scientific war unfolded. Frederick Lindemann, Churchill's scientific advisor, known as the Prof, brought alarming intelligence. Dr. Reginald V. Jones had discovered Nikobine, Crooked Leg, a German radio navigation system guiding bombers along intersecting beams to precise targets, even in darkness. When Flight Lieutenant Bufton detected beams intersecting near Derby's Rolls-Royce factory, Britain immediately began jamming them, creating an ongoing technological chess match. Lindemann was extraordinary: socially awkward, vegetarian in meat-loving Britain, abrupt in manner, yet Churchill trusted him implicitly. Throughout 1940, the Prof sent over 250 memoranda on subjects from high strategy to egg production, championing defensive innovations like aerial mines and even proposing burning oil pipes concealed in hedges to incinerate enemy columns. This scientific war represented something new: warfare increasingly defined by technological advantage rather than military might alone. September 7, 1940. Londoners crowded Hyde Park on a sweltering Saturday, lulled by August's calm. At 4:43 p.m., sirens shattered the illusion. 348 German bombers and 617 fighters crossed the channel, creating what witnesses called a blazing girdle around the city. That first day killed 430 and seriously injured 1,600. The next day, Churchill toured the devastated East End, openly weeping as crowds chanted "Good old Winnie." When one woman demanded action against Berlin, Churchill whirled around, shook his fist, and snarled, "You leave that to me." The perfect rejoinder transformed despair into grim determination. As nightly raids continued, daily life became surreal. Windows were patched with wood, electricity failed, commutes stretched to 4 hours. Yet only 5% sheltered in underground stations, Most refused to let Hitler disrupt their routines. The Blitz also unleashed unexpected intimacy. Young people embraced what one woman called sex at its sweetest, not for money or marriage, but for love of being alive. Each weekend, Churchill escaped to Chequers, the Prime Minister's country estate in Buckinghamshire. This Tudor mansion became his sanctuary and alternative command center, where he summoned generals, ministers, and family for his Circle Sacra, a sacred circle for candid exchanges impossible in London's formal settings. General Alan Brooke described watching Churchill at 2:15 a.m., wearing his many-colored dressing gown, trotting around the Great Hall to gramophone music with sandwiches in hand, delivering priceless quotations. After dinner, fueled by champagne and brandy, Churchill might put on military marches and perform rifle drills while wearing his sky-blue romper suit. Brooke found it both hilarious and memorable, wondering what Hitler would have thought of this demonstration of skill at arms. Yet war was never far away. On November 14, 1940, the Luftwaffe launched a devastating 11-hour raid on Coventry. The medieval cathedral's roof melted, and 40-50% of bodies were unidentifiable. The Germans coined Coventrien to Coventrate, meaning to annihilate a city through aerial bombardment. Church's war cabinet secretly approved Abigail, a plan to launch devastating firebombing attacks against German cities in response. As 1941 began, Churchill knew Britain's survival depended on American support. In January, Harry Hopkins arrived as Roosevelt's emissary. At Ditchley, after Churchill's impassioned monologue about Britain's war aims, Hopkins drawled, "We're only interested in seeing that goddamn son of a bitch Hitler gets licked," bringing relieved laughter. The pivotal moment came at a Glasgow dinner when Hopkins quoted Ruth, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God." Then, softly, "Even to the end." Churchill wept at this promise of American support. In March, the Lend-Lease Act passed. Roosevelt's clever analogy had worked. When your neighbor's house burns, you lend your garden hose without haggling. Then came December 7, 1941. At Chequers, Churchill heard the BBC announce Pearl Harbor. He leapt up. "We shall declare war on Japan." Churchill went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and thankful. America's entry was the decisive alliance he had desperately awaited. 2 months after victory in Europe, the British public voted Churchill out of office. During his final weekend at Chequers, his daughter Mary witnessed the agonizing spectacle of her father's unused energy. As they departed, everyone signed the visitor's book that had recorded the plots and stratagems of the war. Churchill signed last, adding beneath his name, "Finish." Churchill's leadership during Britain's darkest hour exemplifies how one person's courage can transform a nation's fate. He didn't give Britain courage. He focused what was already there, transforming fear into defiance and despair into resolve. From May 1940 to May 1941, his unwavering spirit ensured Britain would stand alone but unbowed, buying precious time until America's entry transformed a desperate struggle into victory. Remember Churchill dictating defiance from his bathtub, weeping in the rubble while promising vengeance, dancing in his romper suit at 2 a.m. while the nation burned? Leadership isn't about having all the answers. It's about refusing to accept defeat when everyone else sees only darkness.